Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
So right now we are in the Jamaquaque Reserve, which is located in the Pacific Forest of Ecuador. And this is an ecoregion that's very unique to not only Ecuador, but to the tropics. You can't really define it as strictly rainforest or cloud forest or dry forest. It's really a medley of all those different forest types compacted into this area that hugs the Pacific coast of Ecuador along the mountains here. We started this project in 2007. A small group of us created an organization called Third Millennium Alliance, otherwise known as TMA. We are about a decade and a half into this project. Our first step was to create the Jamaquaque Reserve, which has been a great adventure and I think has been a solid success. And we're at the point now where we're going to expand northward and create a much larger conservation corridor, which we're calling the Capuchin Corridor, which is named after the critically endangered white-fronted capuchin monkey.
Welcome back to the Look Far podcast. Recording here today in the Jamaquaque Reserve in the Manabí province on the west coast of Ecuador with our friends at TMA. Jerry Toth, welcome back.
Very good to be with you again. Thank you, Scott, for having me. This is fun to do this in the reserve this time.
It's been awesome to be here after talking by Zoom for so many weeks and months, the past year and a half. And obviously you can't really paint a picture with a podcast, but sitting out in TMA's famous bamboo house, can look out and see the Pacific Ecuadorian forest. Probably can hear some of the birds in the background. And just an awesome view and a great day. And really interested to hear how things are going with TMA, what's going on at the Jamaquaque Reserve, and what's coming up and what are you working on?
Yeah, we're in the midst of a pretty big growth phase right now. We spent the first 15 years really building out this reserve in this specific river basin and really learning how to do what we do, trialing a lot of different methods, getting to know all the communities that that surround the reserve. And we are now at the point where we're ready to start building kind of the large-scale conservation corridor northward that we've always been dreaming about. We're waiting for the right moment to go big on that. And everything seems to be coming together right now for that to happen. And so we're at the jumping off point of that. And so that's kind of been the big news for us.
It's a great progression. When you first found this land, for those who might remember, Jerry was our first podcast, episode one, and he talked through the history of the Jamaquaque Reserve, how it started. And that was, 15 years ago?
Yeah, that was 2007. So,
and to have made great progress in the time since then, building out this reserve, doing fantastic science, really revealing and demonstrating its ecological value and forging great relationships with the surrounding community, many of whom can really benefit from having a sort of greater ecological integrity to their surroundings. This jumping off point though, you've built this great foundation, now you can do much, much bigger things that could really have a regional impact. And it's neat to kind of see, and I imagine come back in a few years and this could be double in size, triple in size, and then some.
I think so. Yeah, that's the direction we're going in. And it did take us some time to get to where we are to really know. I think that the big questions for us are, what do we need to do? Can we do it? Can we deliver on what we need to do? And do we have the funds to do that? And for many years, I think we were still working through all those questions. And now all three of those questions seem to be a big yes. We know We have a lot of experience working in this region. We know exactly what we need to do. We know where we need to do it. And we have greater access to funds. And so we want to put it kind of all hands on deck and do as much as we can now. And it's, I think we're poised for a big phase right now.
Yeah. And Look Far's here because we want to hang out in the bamboo house first and foremost.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's really no place like this anywhere I've been. And there's no ecotourism company that could rival, I think, what you've constructed here in terms of its authenticity and its intimacy with the forest, but also to, you know, brainstorm ways we can collaborate and conspire to try and advance your vision, because it's a powerful one. And I think it's much needed given how many, you know, palm plantations we drove through, you know, just to get out this way. So there's an urgency to it that really can't be overstated.
Yeah. It's, it is, as you were saying yesterday, it's quite a different thing to be talking about protecting the Pacific Forest when, you know, if you're sitting in a house in the U.S. and zooming as opposed to sitting here literally in the middle of it, hearing the sounds, you know, smelling the smells, all of that. So it's been fun to work out of here together. That's been, hopefully we can do this more often.
For sure. And also what's fun about being here is we get to spend time, not just with you, but with members of your team, and have three of them here right now. And let's start with Moises. He didn't even know we were going to ask him to say a few words. But Moises, how you doing?
I'm very fine here. This is one of my favorite places in Ecuador.
Tell us what you do for TMA.
Well, I am the parabiologist, so I help all of the researchers, and also I'm monitoring the reserve. And well, when they are in research here, and most of the time I have been seeing birds here and report birds, and also try to learn how to reforest and protect forests in Ecuador. And this had been a nice work. What is my first work, to be honest, but it's my favorite one, and I don't want to leave this work for many times.
Well, it's been awesome to meet with you and hang out with you. And you took, you know, our Look Far co-founder, Julia, on a hike yesterday to the Cloud Forest, just above the reserve, part of the reserve, which I know she loved, and was glad to have you as her guide and to show her around.
Yeah, it was a nice hike because I could share with her my knowledge in the reserve. And it's fantastic to receive people from other countries, because we can share our paradise with them, and that is really nice. And Julia was very interested in forest, and that was really nice. And I hope we will receive more people from other countries to see how this forest and how TMA is working here.
Well, gracias. Moises, mucho gusto. Most importantly, too, Moises knows where the coffee is. So when I was up early before everyone else, I was having a hard time trying to figure out how to make some coffee, and he showed me how to do it. And it's grown, Jerry. The coffee is from the reserve.
Yeah, Hamakwake coffee, homegrown, organic. I'm glad. Yeah, that's and produced by our partners in Tubuga, Agro Tubuga, our good friends. Vico and Danielle and their whole team. So a fully, truly, truly local product in every sense. I mean, the harvested from those bushes over there. Listeners can't see, but I'm pointing to the bushes where we harvested.
Yeah, and it's a neat thing about the reserve, which is on the one hand, it helps protect old growth forest that could very easily otherwise vanish and not survive. On the other hand, you do some really progressive agroforestry and have looked to demonstrate how you can coexist with old growth forest and still produce, you know, valuable staples, whether it's coffee, cacao, vegetables, fruits, other things that can find their way to market and actually be better and be organic and all that good stuff. So it's a great example for the surrounding farming communities.
Yeah, I think that's really important in a place like coastal Ecuador that has been so badly fragmented, is you have these patches of old growth forest, then you have a lot of patches of totally deforested land. And our mission has always been to kind of, all right, let's protect the standing old growth forest, and then let's find ways to reforest what's already been cleared. And when you think of strategies to reforest what's already been cleared, there's different ways to do that, but a lot of this land is on properties owned by small scale farmers. And to make it worth it for the owners, there has to be a commercial benefit for them. And so what are going to be, what are agroforestry products that can help regenerate the land and also pay back the people who are planting and managing those trees? And that's kind of the beauty of agroforestry, is it, if it's done well, it can provide both of those benefits at the same time. And we try to do the best we can at serving as a small demonstration site of that in the reserve. I mean, most of the land in the Hamakwake Reserve, almost all of it is forest, but there's these small little patches that were deforested before we came here. And so we've been kind of taking advantage of those patches to experiment with agroforestry, experiment with reforestation, and then try to apply those lessons in other lands surrounding the reserve.
And then also here, Mike Ellis and Ryan Lynch. Ryan is the executive director of TMA. Mike Ellis is its chief ornithologist, chief scientist. Mike, what do you do here?
Something like that. I started with TMA as an intern back in 2012, became a resident biologist like Moises is now, and went on to become director of research, and then realized if I'm going to be director of research, I should be the best scientist that I can be. So a couple years ago, I started my PhD, and now I am here in the reserve conducting research and advising TMA on all kinds of wildlife studies and conservation initiatives.
And Mike, you are by training as a scientist an ornithologist.
Right. Yes. An ornithologist, very different from Ryan, the herpetologist.
That's right. So the common name of an ornithologist, I'm sure all listeners know, but
right. So hey. I study birds. I'm a birder.
He's a birder. And Ryan,
through and through.
You're a herpetologist.
I am indeed a herpetologist.
And the common name for that, maybe lesser known in the among
much
our,
lesser known, yeah, is a herper.
That's right, herper. So we have a birder and a herper. And very interested to kind of explore the differences. I've been told, you go for a hike with them and, the birder is constantly looking up at the trees and the herper is constantly looking down at the bushes. And so someone ought to be looking ahead just to make sure you don't get lost. But maybe, herping is a little lesser known, but vital. Why don't you tell us what you are interested in and maybe more importantly, why you are interested in this?
Sure. Yeah. So herpetology in general is the study of reptiles and amphibians, and it's been my passion for many, many years. My work here in the Hamakwake Reserve actually was born out of my love for reptiles and amphibians. When I first started coming to the reserve, I was working for another organization called the Biodiversity Group doing reptile amphibian surveys in Hamakwake, and the result of that was a species list of all of the species of amphibians and reptiles that are found in this forest, many of which are quite unique. And over the years, even after transitioning and starting my work with TMA, I have continued to look for as many species of amphibian and reptile in the reserve, including a number of species that are extremely rare, critically endangered, and even a number of species that we now have on a list to be described as unique, novel species, which we're really excited about.
Yeah, tell us about some of those.
Yeah, so our reserve, it is quite unique because we are so close to the coast. We're only a few kilometers from the beach, yet the reserve is located on a coastal mountain range that really juts up from the coast and creates a lot of unique habitats. So we have a diversity of forest types here that transition from very dry forest to very wet and cloudy forest. And it's a mountain range that is disconnected from the Andes mountain range. So it's an isolated coastal mountain range that tops out around 700 meters here in our reserve. And because of that, on the top of our reserve, around 700 meter elevation, you get a lot of very interesting species. Years ago, actually working with Mike, when we first met in 2012, we did discover on a night hike a species of frog that since then we have learned is unique to science, and we're extremely excited about that.
Okay, now who discovered the because as a herper, I mean, that should be something you should be able to do, but...
It should be indeed.
Yeah, but what tell us what happened on that fateful hike.
Yeah, we were going out to set up some camera traps, I believe, on the Cordillera, and then decided to herp our way back as it was pretty late at night. And I think I just happened to be in front, which is probably why I found this new species first. But, you know, my contribution was basically, hey, what's that over there? And then I immediately lost interest and walked away. And then Ryan, I think, had a very different reaction.
Yeah, I saw it and immediately knew that it was something unique. It looked like a species that is found much higher up in the Andes, and it's not a species that is known from this low down close to the Pacific coast. And yet I didn't know for sure what it was because it looked like something that shouldn't be here. And so I was ecstatic that night, and as usual, when I find a species that I can't identify on the spot, ended up taking a ton of photos and short video clips and making sure to highlight the different features of the body that help a researcher identify the species when you get back and can look at the literature. That kind of kick-started, at this point, 7-year journey to investigate and collect more data on this very unique species.
Yeah, and let's stay on that for a minute, because in terms of conserving, protecting biodiversity, you know, why the Hamakwake Reserve, why here, you know, why now and going forward? I mean, Mike, some of your research in the early days, you started finding birds here in the reserve that were not expected or not supposed to be here as well. So it's a lot of rich from a herp perspective. But also from a birding perspective. I mean, maybe you could tell us about some of that work you did.
Yeah, that's right. So when I first started here as an intern working on a reforestation project, I would go birding for fun and just started to put together a species list and was comparing it with field guides and finding all of these things that weren't listed as being in this range. And so I talked to Jerry about it, and we decided that it'd be a good idea to dig into this a little bit deeper. So I stayed on for a year and just tried to find as many birds as I could, did a lot of point counts across the reserve, and ended up finding something like 30 species that hadn't been recorded in this province. And many of them, about 22, were endangered. And so that information was really critical in helping TMA launch some of its first big grant campaigns. And they were really critical for creating the reserve that as it is now.
Yeah, I mean, not just the number of species, but number of threatened species, number of species that are endemic, meaning not found anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And the reserve and the surrounding region has maybe, it seems like unexpectedly proven to be quite a trove for those things.
Yeah, I think there hasn't been a lot of work done out here on either the herp or the bird side. There were maybe two studies back in 1994 and in 2006 that were very limited, basically rapid assessment programs, so lasting only a couple of days. And so having Ryan and I out here doing this kind of intensive work with our collaborators and other groups, we had a lot of interesting discoveries and really learned more about how the hyper-diverse wet choco forest and the very dry tomb-based forest sort of collide in this region, and endemics from both areas sort of congregate here.
Yeah, and when birding, we're here during the dry season, which means it's extremely humid, there's a heavy mist in the air, and thick mud on the trails. And when we were out hiking yesterday, I said, you know, you can't really use your eyes all that much when birding, because you could, I mean, we could barely see, you know, 10, 15 feet behind us and on the trail. And so what do you do as a birder if you're trying to identify and sort of track what's going on, what birds are here?
That's a great question. Yeah, we do a lot of studying of recordings that people did back in the 90s or early 2000s. We do some recording ourselves of birds and that are singing, and then we try to get our eyes on them to figure out what's making what sound. But you also notice if you spend any time with us that we are constantly whistling and annoying everybody around us. As we did on our hike yesterday, Moises and I and Martin as well, who was also out there, we were all just constantly whistling, repeating everything we heard, trying to cement it in our heads. And if we're lucky, calling something in to have a little conversation with it.
Yeah, so you're really birding by ear.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Now, Ryan, as a herper, you don't herp by ear, do you?
You can, actually, okay. Surprisingly. A lot of it is slowly walking at night to really try to spot the animals. But frogs are vocal animals, and you can hear a chorus of different species calling as you walk through the forest at night. And in fact, that is a way to really identify the frog community in a reserve, is to make recordings of all of the calls that are made. And the unique thing with frogs is it is very tied to the seasonality and the climate and the time of day. And so doing it once and going to a particular area in the forest and making a recording doesn't necessarily mean you're capturing all of the species there. But if you repeat it and continue combining that with visual encounters data, then you can really pull together a comprehensive list of what's in any given spot in the reserve.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's always scientists here, often PhD students. This is a great place to do research. The Bamboo House, which we've been talking about, to me is really a research station. I mean, it's not a place, you cannot get a room here. I guess you could.
No, but yeah, it's yeah, not, but, you can't really, I mean.
But it's not open for that kind of thing. And it's really a place if you want to do field work that's any, you know, short of just pitching a tent and camping in the field, this is where you'd stay. But it means, you know, there's no screens, there's no, it's open air. There's not much in the way of privacy. And considering you guys have trained your ears to pick up every little sound, you know, you're living in pretty close quarters. So I'm just curious, how good is it to be for our roommates between the birders and the herpers? Your practices are not quite identical, are they?
Horrible.
Yeah, I think in addition to training myself to learn birds by ear, I've also trained my ears to ignore Ryan at night when he's active.
Very opposite schedules.
Yeah.
With birders up way too early and having breakfast when the herpers are only a few hours into sleep, so very conflicting schedules. And when you're in living in close quarters, it can definitely create some of that conflict between the herpers and the birders.
Yeah, because you're going out at night. You took some of our team out last night.
Indeed.
To see some frogs and I think a tarantula.
Yeah.
And then got in, I think, after midnight or something like that.
Yeah, and that can be an early night for herpetologists. Herpetologists can stay out even later and come back, you know, 2-3 in the morning, even if it's a really active night. And
if you go up to the cloud forest, for example.
And especially, if you want to be out at the time of night when the animals are most active, and for frogs and snakes, a lot of things are more active at night. So when you hike an hour just to get to the top of our mountain range, you want to be up there for a while after that effort. And so you spend a few hours hiking along up in the cloud forest and then still have another hour long hike to get back to the house. So it can be late nights.
Yeah. And Mike, I mean, I'm an early riser and I barely, if not at all, beat you here in the morning. You're up. Is it true that early morning is a great time for birding? Or?
Oh, yeah. And these days have been very relaxing because I've only been waking up at 5:30. So typically birds have a dawn chorus where they set up their territories and they say, hey, back off. This food is mine. And that girl bird over there, she's probably mine too, and so stay off my turf. And that usually ends by 10 in the morning, 11, although there are a few things now, like house wrens, that are going to go all day. But we're typically getting up and banging around pots and pans, making some eggs in the morning when Ryan's trying to be deep asleep.
Nice. Well, this is the first time we've had both a birder and a herper here on the podcast together. And a real treat and a lot of fun. I think we're going to wrap it up because we have some work still we want to get done today. And just curious, Moises, Ryan, Mike, Jerry, any final words to kind of send us out?
Well, I mean, I guess the big news for us is this is kind of almost like the announcement party of the corridor that we're trying to build. So we're trying to, the conservation corridor that we're trying to create, which we are naming the Capuchin Corridor, named after the white-fronted capuchin monkey, which is critically endangered in this region. We haven't yet gone public with that until this very moment. And it's a big step, and that's one of the reasons we're excited that you guys are here, because I think that Look Far will play an important role in that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun for all of us. We've already been exploring a lot of new forests beyond the Hamakwake Reserve that are in the region. And that's just exciting, just to be exploring new forests. We're going to see one of those tomorrow. Meeting new people, meeting new communities, connecting with new people out there. So I think in the coming months and coming years, this is going to be a major deal for not just us, but I think for this whole region. So thanks for giving us the opportunity to kind of put it out there in public.
Yeah, well, we're going to keep checking back in, and you can learn more about your work, tma.earth, E-A-R-T-H, on the World Wide Web, and on social media. I think it's also tma.earth for Instagram.
On Instagram and Facebook and Twitter as well.
Great. Well, if you haven't already, definitely check these guys out. And, I'm still here. I already can't wait to come back.
So, yeah, we look forward to it.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Look Far is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.